Today on The Independent, this is March. It's March 1st, and we welcome in Notre Dame head men's basketball coach Micah Shrewsbury to the show. Plus, Pete and I preview Notre Dame spring practice, which starts next Thursday, March 7th. That and more today on The Independent.
Welcome back to the latest episode of The Independent. I'm Pete Sampson, joined as always by my co-host Matt Fortuna. I think since we last gathered, I've been on the road, hit some alumni clubs. Spring practice, like you said, it's around the corner. Basketball season winding down, both for Notre Dame and the team that I'm coaching. So there's a lot going on, Matt. And I think our listeners will really enjoy the interview with Micah Shrewsbury at the end of the show, both for talking about Notre Dame basketball and then giving me some life advice about how to coach your own kid. I think any dad or mom could benefit from that. But I guess, I don't know if you want to start with hoops. Do you want to start with spring practice? I think since we last talked, Mike Denbrock and Max Bulla were formally introduced, or at least met with the media for the first time. There's never really an off season when it comes to Notre Dame athletics.
No, especially not in college football. I do want to go back to basketball really quickly, though. We haven't gotten into how good your team's doing. You talked a lot about being a coach, and you just introed that the season's coming to a close. Is it a happy close? Are you geared up for a March run? What's the deal here?
We've got four games to go. It has been a lot of learning. I'd say that we are better than we were last year. Are we playing our best basketball at the end of the season? I'm not positive I can say that.
What's the record? You're talking around it.
What is our record? I think that we're about it. Yeah, I do have to think about it. It's been a long season, but we're above 500. We have won more games than we lost. How about that?
There you go. You're champions of life, by Coach Sampson. Ted Lasso on the show.
Yeah. On the coaching front, Bulla and Denbrock both met with the media, I think, a week ago today as we record this show on March 1st. Denbrock, exactly who you remember as Notre Dame's offensive coordinator before, one of the most normal guys in a profession of abnormal people. And talking to people around Notre Dame, and I said this out on the alumni circuit the last couple of weeks, like, this gives Marcus Freeman a Al Golden to run the offense. And that is what he needed in a really acute way after the last 2 years. You can see that come through in the way Denbrock commands a room, how relatable he is, I think, sort of his messaging. And then Max Bulla comes in as well. I just think hashtag football guy. When I spend time with him, he seems like one of those guys where if he popped into a practice, he could actually hang for a minute. A lot of intensity, a lot of energy. And I think for the young linebackers in particular, I think somebody that they will really benefit from, as they did last year. I mean, he was up front in his conversation with the media, like, he was the linebackers coach last year. Al Golden was the defensive coordinator. So this is not a huge transition for him as he takes over the room in full.
Yeah. I mean, he's young enough to still be in the NFL, or younger than some NFL players. We all remember him having a pretty standout career at Michigan State. I think his dad or his uncle was the DC at Syracuse, Chuck. Yep. I believe is at LSU right now, working with Brian Kelly as an analyst. It's been a nice run for Notre Dame on that side of the ball when it comes to kind of grooming and building up a coaching staff. Nick Lozinski a couple of years ago was in many ways a linebackers coach, even though that wasn't his title. James Laurinaitis took on a huge role in that room in his first year coaching football at all. During Marcus Freeman's first year, he obviously went to Ohio State, and he just got promoted to linebackers coach itself in Columbus. So, I think we were both hearing the same thing in real time. Once Chris O'Leary left for the Chargers, it wasn't, hey, who are they going to hire to replace him? It was, they've got their replacement on staff, and they're going to kind of reshuffle some things internally and give Al Golden a little bit more freedom. Golden also, finally, as you have alluded to show after show, signed a lengthy contract extension, a four-year extension, which, much like Mike Denbrock's new deal to come to Notre Dame, is unprecedented, at least in Notre Dame, for an assistant coach. And we've talked ad nauseum on this show about how this administration, how Jack Swarbrick kind of on his way out, is giving this coaching staff and this football program all the tools it needs to succeed in a way that I don't think I've ever seen at Notre Dame before. This is as healthy I think, of a position as this program has been in quite some time.
I agree. I think it's more, it says more about maybe the university than it does about the football program, or equally as much about both. Cause I remember writing a very freezing cold take column in winter of 2016 about like how Notre Dame had everything working for it together. Like there was a little bit more alignment in terms of where the football program was going. That obviously did not age well at all. But I do think with Marcus Freeman, the Al Golden, Mike Denbrock combination, where they are with NIL, I believe that the facilities, they will break ground on Goog 2.0 this year. There's a lot of wind at Notre Dame's back right now when it comes to football. And it's not just that you have a charismatic young head coach who recruits well. It's the fact that you have the university at large backing him in a way that they need to, and maybe didn't always with Brian Kelly. Maybe some of that had to do with Brian Kelly being Brian Kelly. But I think that it all should, if you are a Notre Dame fan and you've been sort of concerned about the all-in or lack of all-inness about this place, the pendulum, I think, is much more toward all-in right now. In my 23 years on the beat, this would be more of the all-in type. And so that maintaining that and maximizing it and taking advantage of that, that's another thing. But I think Notre Dame football and Notre Dame the university, as it relates to its football program, is in a healthy spot.
So I'll one-up you in the freezing cold takes department. On the day of that 2016 opener, I'm going to say Sunday or Monday night against Texas, I had an A1 story on ESPN.com with the headline, Brian Kelly and Notre Dame are in it for life together. So I sat down with Brian for a while and talked about how all in this program is and how everything's finally the way he wants it. And that year they went 4-8 and he didn't lose his job, but it was definitely a talking point throughout the course of that year. But I will agree with you. Things are moving in a very healthy direction right now, top to bottom. I think in some ways, now that they've been able to kind of stomach it, so to speak, or at least figure it out or tailor it to their needs, the NIL era has been really good for them. High school recruiting, we've spent God knows how many hours talking about, can they ever consistently crack that top five, ranking list when it comes to high school prospects? Brian Kelly himself had thrown that out there as kind of his last challenge in his later years in Notre Dame. I'm not saying they will or won't ever get there, but with the way the portal's working now, with the way Notre Dame's been able to get things up to speed as far as admitting people they want and know are capable of succeeding at the school academically and athletically, I think is major. Back-to-back years now where you have a transfer quarterback who was in high demand elsewhere. I think that says a lot about the place. Goog 2.0, well past due. It's necessary, but I will say, like, in the NIL era, I don't know if, like, glitzy facilities is what's going to put you over the top anymore, yeah. Right? I mean, you need to allocate your resources more toward the personnel and talent than you do, the brick and mortar, so to speak. I don't think someone's going to come to Notre Dame because they have a waterfall that's better than Alabama's. They're going to come because they've got coordinators on both sides of the ball who have done it at the highest level and are locked in and not looking to go anywhere, short of maybe a head coaching position elsewhere, along with all the other things they have going for them.
Yeah, I was going to say on The Athletic, I think it was earlier this year, we did sort of like a Recruits Anonymous about, NIL opportunities, what really mattered for college, how did you choose where you were going to go? And overwhelmingly, the feedback was, I'm going to go to the place that gets me best ready for the NFL. That data was not lost on Notre Dame at all. That's the honest truth. NIL is part of the equation, and I think sometimes it's viewed as the entire equation. I just don't think that recruits behave that way. So you got to be a player in NIL. Notre Dame is, with its current roster and retaining its current roster. I think it's become more sophisticated in other elements too. But I just sort of view the facilities as it's a practical developmental space, not a fancy pants, miniature golf course, bowling alley, waterfall, slide in the lobby space. It was never going to be at Notre Dame, whether NIL was a thing or not, But I think the utilities of it now, it's much more obvious what you need those spaces for. And it's less about attracting a 17-year-old kid. And in some ways, it's more about finding a 22-year-old kid who wants to come to Notre Dame as a grad transfer. And it's like, how is this space going to help me best get ready for the NFL?
Right. And even Jack Swarbrick went on the Tim and Tim show, and he mentioned a survey that Notre Dame had conducted with number one reason for coming here.
Yep.
It was, I want to go to the NFL or something to that extent. So looking good in that department. They've got a big turnout at the combine this week. I think NIL, me and you have written it, me and you have said it. I think it's night and day at Notre Dame right now versus where it was a year ago. I think everyone to a certain extent is still figuring this thing out, right? I mean, I think under whatever 33 FBS programs in the country, you go up to any fan base of any one of them right now, and they'll all say, we're not doing enough. Look what our rivals mm-hmm. doing. Look at this. I don't think anyone's saying, like, we got to figure it out. It's a very fluid landscape in that regard. And I think it's going to change even more when you look at some of the court rulings with the NCAA. I think you're going to see some people do more stuff because it's out in the open now. But, you know, if you want to call it the Michigan model, the Ohio State model, whatever you want to call it, I do think Notre Dame has found out their money is best spent, their time is best spent in investing in proven products more than mm-hmm. developmental products. And that's transfers who were ready made, so to speak, more so than high school prospects who,
yeah.
you know, there's a pretty wide range of how good or bad you can be in that regard.
Yeah. Before we touch on basketball a little bit into our Micah Shrewsbury interview, spring practice starts next week, March 7th. I mean, what are you most interested to see?
Offensive line, and I don't know how much you can evaluate that in real time in spring, but when you look at the schedule, the defense, the coaching staff, look, it's probably a preseason top 10 team. I don't know if I'd say it's a preseason top 5 team, although they have more familiarity than I think a lot of the other name brand schools do right now, so maybe they'll get the benefit of the doubt in that regard. But, you know, to put a fine point on it, I mean, this is a playoff or bust season coming up for Notre Dame. And that's going to almost entirely hinge upon how good or bad this offensive line is. And, you know, we've become accustomed to seeing strong offensive lines at Notre Dame. You know, no matter who the coach is there, they've had a continuous kind of replenishment of first-round picks. I mean, David Hale, our friend ESPN, friend of the show, I guess he's working on a project at ESPN. He texted me this week with a list of ND great linemen who are in the NFL now and said, who do you think is the best out of all this? And I said, the answer is Quinnen Nelson, but you didn't even have Mike McGlinchey on this list. And I don't think that was like a disrespect to Mike McGlinchey so much as there have been.
How many linemen were on there?
Hold on, let me pull up. I mean, there were a lot. I mean, it was Stanley was on there. Here, it was Stanley, yeah. Ault, Nelson, Banks, and Eichenberg. And I said, Nelson's the best out of that
Wait,
group.
Wait, Zach Martin wasn't on there?
Zach Martin was on. Oh, of the playoff era, he said.
Oh. Okay.
Even then, still no McGlinchey on there. And, but again, like it's easy to forget about, right? It's like, you know, who's your yep. favorite USC running back during the Pete Carroll era? I don't know, like Bush and all the other guys. There's so many. Is Charles Jagasaw that guy?
Yeah.
I think he could be. Is he going to be that guy? Game one, Texas A&M under the lights. I don't know. Blake Fisher looked like he could have been that guy as a freshman. Then he got hurt. And then Joel ended up being better than him. And then Blake Fisher was, you know, good but not great, you know, his junior year at Notre Dame. So that's where I think all this ultimately comes down to, especially when you have a quarterback who you're going to be more deliberate running the football with, where you have a new offense coordinator who's going to tailor his offense to the personnel he has at hand. We see Mike Denbrock mm-hmm. skin a cat a million different ways wherever he's been. So schematically, football-wise, offensive line is where the entire focus is on right now. And, you know, look, Joe Rudolph is a pretty decorated career. I don't know if I'd say he's Harry Heistand quite yet. He definitely isn't in the reputation department. You know, it's a big year for him. You know, after a year that they were good, but I don't think they were as good as they could have or should have been up front, especially when you look at the Louisville game when they got a little too cute.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It's, and I don't know how much of the, you know, it's these spring practices. It's, there is a little bit of a zero-sum vibe to them sometimes. So it's like if the offensive line struggles, does that mean the offensive line right. is bad or the pass rush is good? Because the defensive line should be outstanding. You know, Cross and Mills on the interior. I'm really interested to see RJ Oben, the other transfer from Duke. And then on top of that, you know, Boubacar Traore is – I think, you know, a sophomore who is built unlike a lot of the other guys on the roster, is probably closer to an Isaiah Foskey physique than anybody else that they've got. How, you know, can he take the next step and be something special? Just maybe not as a starter, but as somebody off the bench who can really pressure you. You know, what does the cornerback position look opposite Benjamin Morrison? I think Christian Gray has a chance to be really, really good for Notre Dame. You know, but Jaden Mickey is there. You know, to, can one of those guys be more than just the other corner? You know, and then obviously it's, you know, with these first spring practices, it's always a, what do the early enrollees look like? Now it's, what do the early enrollees and the grad transfers look like? But, you know, Kingston Viliamaasa, how does he fit in? You know, there's two receivers, Cam Williams and Micah Gilbert, who would be interesting to watch. So there's a lot there. It's interesting talking to some people, you know, essentially people close to players. We'll have people fill in the gaps there. But the sense is that this is such a new team, and it is both very old and very young at the same time, and there's not a lot in the middle. So like how those dynamics work, I think will be interesting. You have all these early enrollees and then all these grad transfers, and then not a lot of, I guess, juniors and seniors. So how the chemistry comes together where you have 23-year-olds and 18-year-olds who are working together, but like are view college football from two completely different lenses. That's kind of interesting to me too, as sort of a spring practice and ongoing story for this team.
Spring is around the corner, and that means it's time to get back outside with Roback, one of our favorite brands at The Independent. Whether it's polos, Q-zips, vests, crew necks, or hoodies, Roback is our go-to apparel when it comes to the golf course, gym, sitting around the fire, or even recording a podcast. You've seen Roback sponsor former Notre Dame athletes Audric Estime, Kyle Hamilton, and Michael Mayer. And if you've attended a Notre Dame game, you've surely seen the Shamrock Polo around tailgates and in the stands. Roback goes by the motto, crave activity, and there's no better apparel to fit those needs. Listeners of The Independent can get 20% off your first purchase by using the promo code IRISH at roback.com. Again, that's 20% off all hoodies, polos, Q-zips, and more on your first order with the promo code IRISH. Visit roback.com.
I wanted to, before we get to Micah Shrewsbury, address the elephant in the room, that is college football playoff expansion. And by the time this pod is posted, maybe they've decided on a 36-team format with 34 automatic bids for the SEC and Big Ten, because that seems to be the rate they're going at these days. However, you know, I think we all had gotten comfortable, or at least wired our brains to accept the 12-team format that Jack Swarbrick and three others.
I was excited to see it.
I'm very excited to see it. Notre Dame fans are excited to see it this year because they have a team that should be in it. Jack Swarbrick, Craig Thompson, Bob Bowlesby, Greg Sankey, only one of whom has not retired since then, Craig Sankey, started in January of 2019, I believe, to devise a 12-team playoff. And they unveiled it in the summer of 21. And it got kicked around and pushed back and forth and finally rubber stamped with the bid process 2 weeks ago. And it sounds like we're probably only going to have that for two more years because the Big Ten and the SEC have decided we're rich, we're good, we don't need anyone else. I think this is all a long play for those two to break off and start their own thing separate of the NCAA. And I don't think we're nearly as far away from that happening as a lot of people seem to think it will be. That being said, 12-team playoff next 2 years, probably 14 2 years after. I don't know anyone who's clamoring for this. If you're the Big 12 or ACC, you get two automatic bids, which is at least one more than you're getting almost every year, but you're also sacrificing a lot in the revenue department and basically conceding that your voices don't matter here. Only the Big 10 and SEC does. But Notre Dame, I think when you see only three at-large bids available, you get a little queasy and wonder, is there a seat at the table for the Irish? But the reports out there indicating that they would have, much like the BCS, their own clause where if they finish ranked in the top 14, they are guaranteed a bid. And we'd have to go back and do the math right now, but more often than not, Notre Dame's looking at a college football playoff team in that format.
Yeah, in the 12-team format, essentially Notre Dame really has to be 10th to make it based on some of the AQ qualifications. And the other one, there may be some fine print that they're automatically in as top 14. We'll see. The devil is in the details on that kind of stuff. But I hate it because I like the idea of merit driving who makes the playoff and not whether you went 9-3 or 8-4 in the Big 12. I don't like the idea. It kills the interest in conference championship games, which I think are going to be getting a boost in the 12-team format. It kills November, or at least wounds November in a way. Right now, November is going to be as interesting as it's ever been from a broadness scale in college football. There have been times where who's racing for the national championship is fascinating in November, but that usually is a 4-team story. This could be a 20-team story. That revives the sport a little bit in a way that I think, or juices the sport in a way that I think is beneficial for everybody. So I just hate AQs because it's trying to build in guaranteed revenues and profits in a sport that thrives because it's so damn unpredictable. That's why we love college football, because you don't know what's going to happen. This feels a lot to me like the worst, like some of the worst impulses of the European Super League that was floated a couple of years ago. I'm a big soccer guy. Like that was much more devastating a prospect than what this is. But it felt like guys in suits wanting to guarantee revenues on spreadsheets, which is not what makes college football great at all and never will.
So I'm just looking back now, and I agree with everything you just said. Notre Dame was 16th in the final playoff rankings last year. Like, all due respect to last year's Notre Dame team, did anyone watch that team and think, man, they really deserve a shot at the national championship? And they were really close. I mean, Louisville was 15, and Louisville would have been in with the 14-team format as the second-best team in the ACC last year. So I just think this sport more and more is resembling, politics, in the sense of the people in charge are not exactly in tune with or representing their fan bases and constituents. Like, the divide there is so great. I don't know anyone outside the people in that room who've been clamoring.
Yeah.
Well, for a 14-team playoff.
To add another political analogy there, it feels like you're gerrymandering your districts here with the guaranteed bids. It just is like, we're going to choose our teams opposed to our teams earning their way into the playoff itself, which is, that's just not what competitive sports is supposed to be about. But that's what people running the sport would like it to be, at least a few of them. So I just find that to be highly disappointing. And I agree with you. The ominous signs of the AFC NFC future of college football are there with the SEC and the Big Ten. I don't know how long it's going to take to get there, but I think as we've seen in the last 5 years, everything moves about 50% faster than what we would have ever predicted. And that's a little bit alarming about where this is all going.
Going back, 2021, the second place team in the ACC, 17th ranked Wake Forest quarterback by Sam Hartman. Again, nice team, nice story. They almost won the ACC that year. Does anyone banging the drum to say we need that team in the playoff? No, absolutely not.
Yeah,
it's just, I don't want to, the devil's always in the details. I think we need to see these things play out. I don't want to say, well, it's going to devalue the regular season or this or that just yet, because there could be some silver linings of that department. But again, we didn't even get a chance to see the 12-team playoff. And that, again, when they announced it, part of the surprise and cheer around it was, oh my God, these people got together and said, we're going to do what's in the best interest of college football, which they never do. They always look out for themselves. How long did the BCS exist for reasons that don't make sense? And yes, popularity in the sport grew and television ratings were through the roof. And eventually they broke off and did the playoff. And they would say, look what the BCS did. No. Like, this sport's in what, its 155th year, and I'd argue the people in charge of it have been trying to screw it up for that long. Like, it's, you can't screw it up. It's so good, but it's nothing to do with the people in charge of it. Like, we're going to watch because the games are awesome. Yeah. And the theory is absurd. Not because a couple suits got in a room and said, let's have guaranteed buys for the big, the guaranteed buy part is the part that really set me over the top. Like,
oh yeah.
Like, why?
Why? I was fine with, like, conference champions. I totally get it.
I'm fine. One, like, conference champions. Yes, I'm fine with.
Go for it.
Guaranteed buys. I mean, look how good some of those Clemson teams were.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the guarantee, because that's...
The Big Ten had how many years in a row where they didn't get into the 4-team playoff and you're guaranteeing them a bye?
I forgot about the guaranteed bye only for the SEC or Big Ten champion, which I enjoyed how that was presented as a concession. Like, well, we're thinking about this. And it's like, well, what was the alternative? A guaranteed spot in the national championship game? Like, what do you want this to be? So, yeah, it's all maddening. The sport... is incredible in spite of the people who are running it. In a lot of instances,
NIL was going to ruin women's sports. Larry Scott went on record as saying that. Mm-hmm. Caitlin Clark has really been terrible for college basketball, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, the people running college sports have been warning of its imminent demise for about 100 years.
Jim Delaney said they go D3 if they ever go to pay for play. And John Jenkins, God bless him, gave a huge A1 story to the New York Times in 2015 saying, we're going to draw a line somewhere and people will still give.
No, they're never going to do that because it's too popular. It is too important to the fabric of the university and frankly, the country to do that. And it's just, I don't know how long the sport will continue on in spite of the people running it, but long may it continue.
It'll be fine. Money will be made. We'll continue to tune in. But yes, I mean, I'm with you. I just, this just doesn't sit right. I genuinely think, I mean, I was driving to Notre Dame for interviews a couple weeks ago when the email hits my inbox, Big Ten and SEC announced a joint advisory group. And I just thought, that's it. Like, these two are breaking off. And that, you know, Tony Petitti and Greg Sankey gave a few interviews saying, you know, we're collaborating. This doesn't mean anything. You know, Jim Phillips and Brett Yormark love this. I'm like, no, this is it. Yeah. And we're seeing that immediately, and I really think this is just a play to take their ball and go home and start their own thing.
Yeah, two foxes have formed an advisory committee, and they will meet in the hen house. Like, okay, great. Yeah, this
we're not calling it an alliance.
Yeah, this is going to go great. That all is maddening. College sports are incredible. We love them, but man, there's just the people running it can be incredibly disappointing. On a much more uplifting note, as at the top of the show, you mentioned it is March. And while Notre Dame men's basketball won't be in the NCAA tournament, their head coach, Micah Shrewsbury, was kind enough to come on the show and spend about 20 minutes with us. I think everyone will enjoy the interview. We talked a lot about the season and just sort of how he got his voice as a coach. What were you most interested to hear from him? And how did you... You know him a little bit better than I do, having, you know, being a Penn State alum. But what were the takeaways from it?
Nice to have a bald guy back on the show, for one.
Yeah, really was.
Nothing terribly surprising, but in the interview so much is, I've just been really, really impressed with the way he's gotten this very young team to play its best ball down the stretch here. Again, he's a good coach. I think we all expect him to succeed at Notre Dame. He's succeeded everywhere he's been. But you knew it was going to be an uphill climb. You knew this was a young team. You knew they weren't going to kind of transfer portal their way into immediate contention the way you can at some other schools. And look, it was rocky early, right? They had a 7-game ACC losing streak. They lost to some terrible non-conference opponents. I brought up with him the post-Citadel press conference where he ripped into his team and, you know, that can be alarming to a lot of people, but, you know, he knows what he's doing and it's worked out well for him. I've just been very, very impressed with the way these guys, again, this day and age of college athletics, and he alluded to this, he said there are some teams that are already out there thinking about Cancun. Yeah. And I think he's 100% right. The fact his team's not only not thinking about that, but like they're continuing to get better after what, let's face it, it's been a trying season. I mean, they're not a really good basketball team. They've won 4 out of their last 5 games. The one loss was almost just the most miraculous comeback ever at Syracuse. They were down 29 points, ended up losing by three. So I just think all the markers of having the right guy and having a great program to build in the coming years is there. And to hear him, I wasn't too surprised about it, but, you know, ask him about Notre Dame and this and that. And he's just like, you know, he said, I had my calendar for March 1st yesterday, 'cause I forgot it was February 29th. Like I've not come up for air. Like, I'm focused on getting better today. And that's the way we're going about our business. You know, I think the guy succeeded everywhere he's been, and I have no doubt he's going to succeed in Notre Dame.
Yeah, it's a fun interview. We'll jump into that now. Matt and I will probably return a week or so from now after the first spring practice recap, March 7th. It's fully open practice, so there will be a lot to see, a lot to learn there. We'll get Marcus Freeman after the fact. So the Independent will return in early March with some spring practice coverage. But for now, Notre Dame's men's basketball head coach, Micah Shrewsbury.
We are now pleased to be joined by Notre Dame head men's basketball coach, Micah Shrewsbury. Micah, appreciate you joining us. You guys have won four of your last five games, and the one loss was damn near the biggest comeback in ACC history. How have you gotten these guys to play their best ball down the stretch, especially after a shaky start?
I think that's been our goal this whole season, is we want to be playing our best at the end of the year. And we've really come together as a group. We've been holding each other accountable. You know, we've stayed consistent defensively, which is challenging, right? When you're not playing your best on offense, and when you're not, you know, having success or wins, we're still competing every night defensively, and that's given us a chance. Now our offense has kind of come along and starting to pick up, and that's really helped us, you know, get some wins here late.
At what point in the year did you feel like you had your feet under you, traction, like that this was moving in the direction you wanted it to move in? Because we see results, right? You see box scores. But I would imagine maybe there's a practice or two that jumped out where you felt like, okay, even if we're in the middle of a seven-game skid here, I can see things starting to turn. Have there been moments along the way that you saw?
Yeah, I think so. Just even like you said, during that seven-game losing streak, there were things that we were doing. There were things that we were doing in practice, and guys were starting to implement it in their games. You could see like small bits and pieces growing, right? And like, I can see it because I'm there every day. I know what we're talking about. But, you know, like if you're only judging on wins and losses, you don't see the small changes. And now those small changes are starting to come through. I think in a lot of ways, guys are adding small pieces to their game, and it's been benefiting us. So, I've been pleased with it. I've been happy with it, like who our group is, but how we're starting to add small tweaks that, you know, people may not even notice, but we see it as a group. We see it as a staff, and our guys are getting confidence from that. Going from practice prep into the games, it has really picked up.
Micah, your two leading scorers are freshmen, Marcus Burden, your son, Braden. What is it about these two that have allowed them to excel at the college level their first year, and seems at least from afar to avoid that freshman wall that everyone talks about?
I think those two guys, like the first thing you would say about them is no fear, zero fear. Like they don't care who they're playing. They don't care where they're playing. They feel like they're the best players on the court. And you need that, right? You need that confidence. That's what's made them good probably their whole lives, is that no fear kind of attitude. Then they play well off of each other. You know, Marcus's total floor game, you know, for the month of February and going into March now, has really gotten better, right? He's been scoring. Obviously, he's been doing that since the start, but how he's passing the ball, how he's reading the defense, making plays, whether it results in assists or not, has really picked up. And then his defense, he's clued in on what we're doing. He knows the game plan, and those two guys have done a really good job for us as freshmen. So it's fun, right? Like, you know, knowing that, like seeing those two guys, knowing what they're doing, knowing how they're playing, knowing how they're competing.
You know, I'm going to go back to my the question about like the bits and pieces you've seen in practice that are implemented in games. But I was interested, like, did you need a game like Wake Forest the other night where essentially your guys got paid, like, for all the work that they did, like, the check arrived with a game like Wake Forest, where you beat a good team on your home floor like that. How significant is that just for the guy? So it's kind of a proof of concept in a game that it paid off.
Those are always really good for, especially a young team, right? Because like you need some validation, right? We've gotten some as we've won some games, but you need some validation at times that like to stick with it. Like they've done it, they've stuck with it. They're come to practice with a great joy every day, whether we win or lose. Their attitudes have been great, but like this gives us a little bit more push now for the end, right? With three more regular season games left, the conference tournament, like this gives us that little bit of push to say, let's keep going. Like we're having a lot of fun playing right now. We're having a lot of fun being with each other every single day. And, you know, for a team with 11 wins, there's a lot of the teams right now that have already quit. And there's a lot of the teams across the country that are thinking about Cancun or the transfer portal. Right. And this team, like they don't, all they're worried about is the next game. And I told them before last game, like at some point in time, there is going to be no next practice. There's going to be no next game. And if you don't value these moments right now, a couple years down the road, you're going to be, you know, missing what, you know, what it is and mad that you didn't give your all.
Mike, I want to go back to December 19th. You lose by 20 at home to the Citadel, and you got pretty fiery post-game, about as blunt as you'll see a head coach in this day and age go publicly, you know, at his team. Some people like it, some people don't, but yeah, I saw you last year at Penn State. You did that twice. You did it after Purdue, you did it after Rutgers, and both times you guys bounced back with, I think, your two biggest wins of the year. In this case, you beat Virginia a week later by, I think, 22. As a coach, how do you hone your voice and figure out when is the right time and the right approach to really go all in like that and fire these guys up and know it's not going to backfire?
Yeah. You know what? Like for me, like I wear my heart on my sleeve, man. There is nothing fake or phony about me. Like what I say is what I mean and what I believe in. But also like, I would never say anything to the media or in the press conference that I haven't already said to our guys, right? So it's not a surprise. Like they had heard that. They heard it in the locker room. But there also is like, there has to be something there with it. There has to be some kind of follow-up, but there has to be a process before that. Like if those guys don't know I love them, then they're quitting on me right there in that moment in time. But like, I care for those guys, man. Like, you know, I want what's best for them. I've had a lot of success. I've been blessed, man. Like what I've been able to do and what basketball has been able to do for me. I've had a lot of success. Like I want it for those guys, but also know what it takes and what we were giving and what we had that we weren't giving. So sometimes it needs to be said, but then there was follow-up. There was great follow-up and, you know, we all owned it. Like I had a lot of faults and, you know, I let those guys challenge me on those. But we came out of that stronger.
That sort of gets into something I want to ask about. There was a cool picture of you with Marcus Freeman last night at the women's game. And I think Marcus is a pretty highly emotionally intelligent guy. What you're describing after the message of Citadel also requires a lot of emotional intelligence. So I was interested just in terms of your relationship with him. If you guys have similarities, differences in how you approach things and how much you've gotten to know him or lean on him here in your first year at Notre Dame.
Yeah. Like just the moments that we get a chance to, you know, we text a lot, we try and talk, you know, throughout times. It's hard because his season's going on and we're not in season, like, but we're getting ready. You know, so I get a chance to try and pop into practice or see him before games or things like that. Now, like, he goes into recruiting season right after his season. And then, like, we're right in the midst of ours, right? So we don't get a lot of time to to spend together. But those moments are great when you just get a chance to pick each other's brain, to talk about what's going on, to I know he's a big guy and learning from others, right? You see him traveling, you see him going to different places. Like, those are the things that I love too, is talking to other people and picking their brains. So we'll get an opportunity to spend more time together, hopefully, when things slow down. But I don't know if things do slow down.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if that's happening.
You know, we're both always recruiting. I got some USA basketball stuff this summer. He's getting ready for his season. But we'll get moments here and there just to pick each other's brain. And you know, I'd love to lean on him and his experience. And just like with everybody else, all the other coaches that we have here, I love those moments that, you know, you can learn from. You know, our sports are really similar. They don't look that similar, but all of our sports and team building and everything else is all similar in what we're trying to do.
It's funny you mentioned that, because we're at 11 months now since you got here, almost a year, and it feels like in some ways it was just yesterday. What have you learned about the place that you didn't already know? Obviously, you're familiar with Jack, you're familiar with South Bend, but being the head coach now for almost a year, what's different and unique that you didn't really know you were getting into?
You know what? I don't know. They ask me these things all the time, right? Like, sport administrators or Jack or Pete, and they're, you know, they're like, hey, what can we do? Like, what things can we change? What do you need to be better, right, for next year? And like, I have to, like, I'm a thinker, I'm a processor, right? I got to sit down and really go through these things. But it's hard for me to do that when we're in the season, because nothing else matters, right? Like, basketball and my family, and that is it. And that's all I'm thinking about, is how we're going to beat Clemson, right? How we're going to guard PJ Hall and, you know, limit Joe Girard's shots. Like, so once we get in the season, I get so locked in on that a lot of times I have no idea what's going on around me. You know, like the practice plan yesterday said March 1st. And that's an honest mistake. Like, I knew it was a leap year, but I thought the 29th was on Wednesday, but I have no idea. I'm just thinking about what's next and what's right in front of me. So there's time for that, of what to change, but nothing's really surprised me. There haven't been anything that's jumped out. I'm like, whoa, I wasn't sure about that. I wasn't prepared for that. Nothing has happened yet. Now it'll be time to say, what can we tweak? What can we make better? How can we make this the best, you know, the best place that it can be?
I want to ask you a little bit about your coaching background. We talked about this before, hit record. Like, I'm a DePaul alum. You worked there. Said you almost went there. Brad Stevens was a year ahead of me in school. I remember covering him on the basketball team. Like, your time at DePaul, Wabash, you know, even IUSB, how that has informed how you coach, how you talk to kids, how you sort of see the profession.
Yeah, that time there. So it's funny, when you get into coaching, there's a couple of different avenues, right? You can go to the Division I side and kind of work your way up in a lot of different ways, but you don't really get a chance to coach, right? If I'm a graduate assistant, or if I'm a video coordinator or whatever it is, and you got to work your way up, you don't get on the floor. Like, how do you develop your voice as a coach? How do you like kind of get your philosophies? Working at the Division III level right away helped me. Right there's like one head coach and like one assistant. So you got to learn like how to run drills. You got to learn how to prepare for games. Like, I was doing scouts right away at the University of Indianapolis right out of college. So it helped me grow as a coach. And now, you know, It's cool for me. I've seen probably in the last 3 days recruiting at the women's game last night, guys that played for me at IU South Bend. And I tell those guys all the time, like, I apologize, man. Like, you know, I was 30 years old when I took that job, and I thought I was ready to be a head coach. And I got there and I had no idea, right? Like, you just don't know how hard it is. Even at that level, you don't know how hard it is. But also didn't know who I wanted to be, right? I was trying to be Ron Jersa, who I worked with at Marshall. I was trying to be Mike Beitzel, who I played for, Mac Petty, Bill Finland, like all these different coaches I worked for, but I wasn't being myself. Right now, as I left there and I went to Butler, worked with Brad for 4 years, worked with Paint at Purdue for 4 years, went to Boston for 6 years. It helped me really develop and grow as a coach in terms of what I wanted to do, how I wanted the program to look, how I wanted to play offensively, defensively. It changed so much. And now when I finally got that shot at Penn State, I was comfortable. Like I know what kind of program I want to run, right? I know what it needs to look like, the success that we need to have. I know the kind of kids we need to recruit. So that helped me so much. Like coaching at that early age helped me grow as a coach. And then coaching in Boston, coaching with Brad and Paint helped me really develop my philosophies.
Micah, do you think that's even more valuable now in this transient era? I mean, you go to Penn State, transfer heavy roster last year. You're at Notre Dame, freshman heavy roster this year with all the turnover and so many new faces every single year on every team. Just having that kind of core identity and principles and being able to adapt it to whomever the 12 men you're coaching, do you think that background coming up the way you did helps right now?
No, I think it's key. The one thing is you have to have a plan, right? Especially now in this day and age, you have to have a plan and then you got to stick to that plan no matter how fast it shifts or changes, right? So you get to Penn State. Here's what our plan is. Here's how we're going to recruit it. Here's how we're going to build it. Like, we're going to take these kids for this year that have 1 year left, and then you transfer them out to bring in five freshmen that you're going to build and grow with, and then plug in your holes with – we took a couple of transfers that fit with the guys that we had left, and then we took off, right? Like, same thing here. Like, I came in with a plan. Here's how we're going to do it. Is how we're going to stick with it no matter what happens. Like, you stick to your plan, good, bad, whatever. Like, you got to give it time to really grow and manifest itself. Now there might be tweaks and changes that you have to make, but you got to stick with your plan nonstop. But being able to coach a few different ways, a few different styles, you got to adjust to your team. And you can't be stuck in being just one way. And you might have a different, totally different team the next year, right? I go back, the first year at Penn State was kind of similar to this team. We weren't great offensively. We were, I think, probably in the 150s offensively, but we were top 50 defensively. But the team that next year shifted based on our personnel, we turned to an offensive team, right? We were like 13th in the country. We were an offensive juggernaut, but I chose to go small when the rest of the Big Ten was big. So that hurt our defense, right? Now I had to flip it based on this year's team. Here's what's best for us in this year. And I think if I don't have the opportunity to work at a lot of different places, it's helped me broaden my horizons as a coach, right? Now, I don't think anybody can say he's a defensive coach, he's an offensive coach. Like, I'm a basketball coach, man. Whatever our team needs, I can do it.
I got one question. My son is a 10-year-old basketball kid. I'm the head coach of his team. Shout out to the Stanley Clark third and fourth grade team that I'm coaching. Coaching my own son has been incredibly rewarding and exasperating, sometimes within the same minute. So this isn't a question as much as a plea for life advice. What's the key to coaching your own kid and getting the most out of it for him and for yourself as a dad?
Yeah. You know what? I didn't start until he got here. Right? I never coached him. That was one. Like, I never coached him. Like, we worked out a lot. We did a lot of stuff in the driveway. He's watched a lot of basketball. He's watched me coach a lot of games. But I'd say the biggest thing, here's the biggest thing for us, is he has to, and now, your son doesn't have a choice, right? Because he's in third and fourth grade.
Yeah, he likes to think he does.
Yeah, so he doesn't have a choice. But Brayden has a choice. Here's the choice that I give him. Like, when practice is over, right? And we leave the building, like I'm dad. So when we get home, I want him to come home for dinner. If he wants to come home for dinner, if he wants to come home and just sit on the couch and watch TV, I have to allow that, right? I can't be talking to him about jumping to the ball or like trailing down screens or something at home, or he's never going to come home. He's like, man, I can't get away from you there, and I can't get away from you here. So there has to be a balance, right? One thing I talked to a bunch of different coaches who had coached their kids, and Ron Hunter was one that he said, you just don't want to mess up that relationship, right? He's your son forever, right? You coach him for 4 years, but he's your son forever. Don't let something happen during that time that he ends up resenting you after the fact. So just keep it fun, right? Coach him like you'd coach anybody else. And then when you get home, like, it's got to be over. It can't, like, the two things can't come together. There has to be a coach and there has to be a dad.
Awesome. Well, on that note, Micah Shrewsbury, appreciate you joining the show. The Irish close out their home schedule Saturday against Clemson. Micah, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Enjoy your weekend.